Hey, welcome to the Seattle Kitchen. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Chef Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
We are coming to you from the Pacific Marine Expo down here at the CenturyLink Event Center. Happy to be, what is this, Tina, maybe our fifth year?
At least our fifth year. Our favorite time of year to come down here and check out all the fun things happening in the world of fishing.
If you ever wanted to see a real live boat motor, this is the place to come. It's not even in the boat. It's just sitting there right on the floor over there. And there's lots of boat motors here and propellers and captain seats, and it's like all the parts of a boat all spread out on a big dance floor. So
if you've ever dreamed of buying a boat, this is a place to come.
Exactly.
It will wake you up.
Especially a fishing boat. I'm Tom Douglas. I'm owner of a restaurant group here in downtown Seattle, and of course the Hot Stove Society, where we normally do our show every week. If you ever want tickets to come check us out, it's $20, and typically we tape on Tuesday mornings from 9 to 11, so come join us and get breakfast and coffee with us at the show. I have a big surprise today. Tina doesn't even know this yet, but we're going to be doing a big giveaway today for some of our Facebook listeners. So if you have a Facebook account, you might want to get that ready.
Seattle Kitchen on Facebook. Log in right now.
Log in right now, exactly. Also on the show today, like I said, we're here at the Pacific Marine Expo. We're going to talk pollock with the folks from Genuine Alaska Pollock Producers. Looking forward to that. It's one of those seafoods that is sustainably caught, the biggest biomass of seafood coming out of our oceans today, and it has many uses. Most commonly, we see it around town in surimi products, like fake crab or what we call fake crab, but it's
time we eat it the way it is as opposed to be fake.
Well, possibly. I like it both ways. I love that little seafood salad you see in grocery stores that has surimi and celery and onions and things.
Cool.
We're going to talk about the latest trends in fishing with the editor-in-chief of National Fisherman Magazine, there's some 500 exhibitors here, so I'm not sure if we'll find any of those to come on the show, but we're going to continue on our series, the Joy of Cooking cookbook series. We had Megan Scott and John Becker in, and they talked about the history of Joy Cooking there, and now this week we're going to talk about part of the update of Joy of Cooking, which has got 600 new recipes to choose from, along with some of the classics that have been in there since 1931, when Irma Rombauer first did it. This guy, John Becker, is Irma Rombauer's great-grandson.
Great-great-grandson.
Isn't that awesome?
And a side note, Tom, I hate to interrupt you, but there's just a lot of sound behind us. And what that is there's like a fishing conveyor belt or something being displayed behind us. So you might hear some parts of fishing boats during the show today as we're here at the Pacific Expo.
Yeah, because, you know, so many of the people that are up there fishing right now are on factory trawlers where they process the fish. And there's just lots of things, whether it's gathering the nets in on the gill netters or whatever it is that happens to relate to the fishing industry is happening right here, right now, live.
It's as if we're inside a big engine.
Yeah, exactly. So that's Tina Knoll. She is our producer from Large Media. Chef in the Chapeau has joined me today.
That's right, Mr. Douglas. I'm very happy fishing today. Very happy fishing. It's critical.
So, Chef, let's do a little ordinary to extraordinary when it comes to fish.
Tuna.
And then shellfish and things like that. So let's talk about clams. One of the things that you see at the grocery store mostly, like I shop at Shoreline Central or Met Market or Mutual Fish down on Rainier Avenue, and you always see live tanks full of clams. What would you do to take an ordinary steamed clam? Let's just say that steamed clam is steamed in either beer or white wine and shallots or something. That's kind of the ordinary way to do it. How would you make it extraordinary?
Well, I just made some a couple of nights ago. Kathy had some sausages and we got from Butcher, Crowd Cow. Mm-hmm. You know, we get some beautiful sausages and took the sausages and broke them down in small pieces. And I did a sweat in some onion in olive oil, added all the sausages, a little pepper, put all the clams in there, a little dash of white wine, steamed the clam really nicely till they pop open.
Mm-hmm.
And then took the clams out and the meat, a dash of cream, and then cooked the whole thing down, put everything back in the pot and a bunch of chopped parsley right on top, and it was delicious.
Delicious.
It was delicious.
So there's a couple of different sausages you could use. I think the most popular one these days is just some fresh chorizo, right?
Yeah, chorizo is very popular.
Spanish-style chorizo, right? Because the Mexican-style chorizo will break up and be all kinds of... It's just not the right texture for a steamed clam dish, but the Spanish-style stays together as a sausage, and it's a delicious...
Another item you can use is bacon, too. Rendered bacon inside your clam is a... delicious flavor addition, especially if it's lightly smoked. For some reason, clams do like this kind of behavior. So
when you buy the live clams from your grocery store, what I do is I take them home. I try to immediately unwrap them because they do need air.
Right.
Or else if you keep them wrapped up in a plastic bag and in the brown paper, they can't breathe and then they'll start to die on you. So I open them up, put them in a bowl, and put a wet towel on top of them.
Correct.
Put them into the fridge. From there, that's where I take them until I'm ready to cook them. From there, I rinse them in cold water. And what I'm two things there. I just want to get the grit off of them, but I also want to, when the fresh water hits them, they'll close up if they're alive.
Right.
Right? And so now I can look through and see if there's any open ones that I don't want to cook with the rest.
Right.
So that's kind of the way I use to make sure that I'm working with live clams. Any other tricks you use?
A trick is to use a little knife blade and put it through the clam, right at the mouth of the clam, to see if the clam reacts. Because sometimes when you take them out of the fridge, they're a little bit dormant, so they're not really reacting to the water or to. Mm-hmm. So you gotta touch them a little bit. One thing for sure, you don't want to deal with a clam that's not closing. And once they're cooked, you don't want to deal with a clam that does not open.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things are very important. You don't eat those because you can get really sick with those items. So.
That or sometimes the clam that doesn't open is just a sand clam, right? So
right.
When you do pop it open, all of a sudden you've let sand out into your whole deal. And if that does happen, you can save it by putting it through a linen napkin and putting your broth through a linen napkin.
Right.
Now, you're going to lose all your bits and pieces in the broth,
right,
but it's better than throwing away all the clams.
Absolutely. And there are butter clams out there that are bigger clams. Those are great to make a compound butter with some garlic, some shallots and chives mixed the whole thing together, put that on top of your clam and put that on your shelf in the oven. Nice heat. It's going to bake by itself. Little breadcrumb on top. You'll have a beautiful baked clam.
Lovely. All right, or just put some steamed clams over top of a nice big chunk of halibut.
Oh, that too.
Yeah, I love doing that kind of mixture of seafoods on your plate. Coming up, we're going to talk all things fishing with Jess Hathaway, editor-in-chief of National Fisherman on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. We're coming to you live from the Pacific Marine Expo down here at the CenturyLink Event Center. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in hats.
It's time to introduce Jess Hathaway. She's the editor-in-chief of National Fisherman, a magazine here that is the largest commercial fishing publication in the United States. It covers fishing industry issues and news from the Atlantic coast to the Gulf and from West Coast to Alaska. National Fisherman Magazine is also a sponsor of Pacific Marine Expo. Hello, Jess. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You are sitting out in the audience, our immense audience watching the show today.
Wow, a lot of people here.
And tell us what's going on with National Fisherman and what are the hot topics in the industry these days?
Well, our hot topics in the industry are definitely going to be on the show floor today. We've got our keynote panel on Pebble Mine. There's a lot happening.
I'm sure there is.
Give us a quick update.
Unfortunately, there's a little too much happening there. So the update is that the comment period on the draft environmental impact survey closed in the spring, the Army Corps' draft environmental impact statement. And the comments essentially show that it was based on very deeply flawed science, mm-hmm. and it was kind of slapdash put together. And the industry is certainly very concerned that it's going to be rammed through. And the commercial fishermen for Bristol Bay actually used Freedom of Information Act requests to get a timeline on where they are in the final environmental impact statement process. And they're expecting that the coordinating agencies will be gathering to assess that in the beginning of the year. So as we go into January of 2020, they'll be looking at that. And they're expecting the final EIS to be published in March.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not opening that to public comment. As far as
of course not.
So just a reminder. reminder to our listeners, the Pebble Mine is the largest open-pit copper and gold mine in the world, proposed for the headwaters of Bristol Bay.
That's right.
And it is one of those things that we've been fighting for many, many years, and, of course, has been put back into play with the new administration as things happen.
Right.
And so here we are. We're still fighting. And, I always challenge our listeners to get personally involved, get informed on the subject.
Absolutely.
And if you go online, you can read or watch the film called Frontline from PBS, which has both sides of the story, or you can go on and watch The Breach and learn more about wild salmon in general.
Yes.
What else is going on?
Well, today at that panel, we will be talking about what people can do next,
mm-hmm.
you know, the steps that they can take next. We've got a bunch of experts on the panel, and we want to make sure that people are aware of the critical need to stay on top of what's happening and to stay engaged and to do whatever they can do, press their, you know, their federal representatives to, you know, pull all the weight that they can to fight this.
So if someone cannot attend today, is there a place they can go and get more information from?
Absolutely. They can go to nationalfisherman.com for that.
There you go.
So other key issues facing fishermen right now?
Well, right now, the other big topic certainly is California Dungeness.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to drop pots today for an opener tomorrow in the central coast of California, and that has been delayed. The fishermen actually volunteered to delay their opening, which is kind of a big deal. So they did a flyover with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they saw more whales than they are comfortable with seeing in the area. And the fishermen in Bodega Bay voted to delay their season and until they can do another flyover and see that the whales have dispersed a little bit more. And essentially, they're chasing their food, and the herring are in a concentration, and the whales are in a concentration, and that's very concerning to the fishermen.
So is that because the whales get entangled with the crab pots and lines?
Yes, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
That is very noble of the fishermen to recognize this and not just jump in for their money.
I agree.
That is very noble. And that should be noted, because there was a time when nobody cared. Today doesn't seem to be the case, and they need to be applauded for that, because that's people who understand and the circle of life works when everybody works together, not one just for themselves.
Yeah, the Dungeness fishermen in California have been working for years on a gear working group with stakeholders from throughout the industry and environmental groups, and mm-hmm. they've been committed to finding new ways to avoid entanglements and any other issues that they might have with their gear.
We're talking with Jess Hathaway, the editor-in-chief of National Fisherman Magazine. I've been hearing a lot about water temperature. How are the fishermen feeling about water temperature, and can they see the creep when it goes around into different areas? Can they see it literally overnight in how they fish?
Yes. I mean, definitely. Mm-hmm. Fishermen are watching mm-hmm. water temperature changes from coast to coast, and some are remarking on major changes, and some are seeing subtle shifts, but mm-hmm. even a small change can really change what you're seeing for fish in the area.
Right, exactly. Is the continuing rebound of the Northeast cod fishery happening? I mean, I know there was a long pullback there, right, because there wasn't enough fish, and we thought that maybe it was heading in the right direction. How's that going?
Well, what would be really great is if we could get some good quality data out mm-hmm. of the Northeast sampling survey. There's been some pushback on getting cooperative data included in the surveys, and New England just doesn't do it as well as Alaska does.
Uh-huh.
Almost no one does, but we'd really like to see some better data. The way that they trawl, the gear that they use, the fact that they don't have fishermen on board those survey boats is detrimental to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Any topics on the aquaculture going on in the Puget Sound with the new open pen? Salmon trout wanted to be raised in there?
I think there's always going to be movement there. Yep.
So what does that mean?
You're staying PC on that one.
Well, there's a lot of money.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of money invested in those net pens. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, personally, I'd prefer to see all, in terms of growing fin fish.
I think we all do.
I'd like to see it land-based, personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm a big proponent of mariculture. Any sort of aquaculture that works with the ecosystem is is fantastic.
Which would be what? Like mussels, clams, oysters?
Mussels, clams, seaweed. You know, seaweed mm-hmm. has been shown to be net positive for mm-hmm. ocean acidification. And so I think we really need to look at what do we want to get out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, not just money.
And also, right. how long do we want to get it out of the water?
Yeah.
Sustainable practices is something we're always concerned about. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Is there a fish out there that we don't know about as chef and restaurants that we should be using more than the others, besides salmon and halibut?
Pollock, right?
And cod?
Yeah, I mean, use them all.
Use them all.
Anything that you see that's wild, U.S., capture, you know, I would say try it, experiment with it. And, you know, I encourage home chefs to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you can find so many different types of whitefish and they all cook up a little bit differently, but there's nothing to be afraid of with mm-hmm. fish. Just try it out.
And chef, you know, that's important, right? Yeah. When she says use them all, it means a couple of different things.
Correct.
But I think the biggest one is that we don't focus on individual species like maybe just salmon or just halibut
right.
and then wipe them off the face of the earth, right? I think the idea is to utilize a biodiversity of different seafood products so that we keep things in balance.
Right. And, you know, I don't think there's any such thing as a perfect balance in a biodynamic environment. I mean, that's the beauty of having access to wild fish. It's not like any other protein that we have mm-hmm. access to. So if we are experimenting and using what's abundant at the time, then we can cycle through whatever is abundant at the time and not be hard hitting on any species. And you know, all of our fisheries are managed for sustainability in this country, which is fantastic. But that also means that, you know, that some are up and some are down.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the nature of fisheries.
Cool. Right. Well, thanks, Jess. Jess Hathaway has been our guest editor-in-chief of National Fisherman Magazine from coast to coast, north and south, covers the entire fishing industry. So looking forward to hearing more about that. And speaking of pollock, we have the wild Alaska pollock and fishing innovation with the genuine Alaskan pollock producers and Trident Seafoods on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Okay, we're back in the Seattle kitchen. It's exciting to be here. We're at Pacific Marine Expo 2019 down at the CenturyLink Events Center. And we are talking fish all day long. You know, I was...
one of my favorite subjects, seafood in Seattle.
What's your favorite seafood?
You know, I'm a very proud ambassador of salmon, wild salmon,
wild
all
salmon.
Over the country. I go do a lot of events all over the country. And I'm always... The first thing that comes to mind is to take wild salmon because... I'm so sad to see that a lot of people have no idea what great salmon tastes like. We're so privileged because we take it for granted. I mean, I have it so often. I've been here for 32 years, and I don't get tired of having a wild piece of salmon.
I totally agree with you, although I like so many different things.
I like everything, too.
I'm on a king crab kick right now, and I've been eating a lot of pollock because my friend Mark Snyder works at Trident Seafood, and they're a big pollock producer.
That's right.
And always trying to think of new things to do with that fish because it's so sustainable. I'll read right here. It's the best-kept secret everyone needs to know. Wild Alaska pollock is a delicious, flaky white fish that is remarkably versatile, quick, and easy to prepare, and comes from the most abundant, certified, sustainable fishery on the planet. Telling that story is the job of genuine Alaska pollock producers. So we have a couple of those here today. Craig Morris is here. He's the CEO of Genuine Alaska Pollock Producers. And we have Robert Dostel, president of Global Seas, right here in over in the Magnolia neighborhood of downtown Seattle. So
great place to keep an eye on fish.
Welcome to the show, guys. You're gonna have to put those mics straight up
here.
Yeah, right there is perfect.
Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. So tell us about pollock. Why is it? I mean, we've been trying to get pollock out in the mainstream for years as a center of the plate fish, and we've struggled and struggled and struggled. So I know we're still at it, but why is that? It's such an affordable, delicious, lovely piece of seafood to work with.
You know, I think it's a product that's just been hidden in plain sight. I think it's a product that meets consumers where they are, mm-hmm. and I think that's the job of Gap and obviously you know, evangelistic board members like Bob here, that we're trying to do what we can by the industry, putting its money where its mouth is, funding partnerships, funding research, doing a lot of consumer work to make sure that consumers understand its story. Mm-hmm. The things that you just talked about, coming from the pristine icy waters of Alaska, it's a wild-caught fish, it's mild, it's flaky, it's versatile. It really meets consumers where they are, and so mm-hmm. we're just putting
cooks
a name on that.
Easily.
Unbelievably
which is
easy
more, that's my topic. Whole topic is cooking it, and it's very easy to cook.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things that we're seeing with consumers today is they're looking for proteins that are an ingredient in the products that they want to make. While Alaska Pollock really takes to ingredients really well, takes to flavors, it's something, the versatility is something that I think is helping us really put it on the map. Right now, we've got, for the first time ever, in the chilled seafood case at Walmart's, you can find a chilled while Alaska Pollock filet. So mm-hmm. all the work that the industry has done to really build a beautiful halo around wild-caught Alaskan seafood, now while Alaska Pollock is just starting get those products to market that can really capitalize, you know, on that beautiful story. And for consumers that are really looking for where their food comes from, that whole provenance is something that's really important to consumers today. I think we're really in the right place at the right time.
So quickly explain to the listeners, Pollock is a fairly flat fish. We're going to call it flat fish. And
looks
it's
pretty round to me, Chef.
Frozen on the... I'm sorry.
We have our mascot, Dutch, here. So
frozen on the boat.
Frozen at sea.
Filet and frozen on the boat, right?
Yes. So one of the things that in our consumer testing that's really come out really well is that frozen at sea, that once frozen message, the consumers can understand that although it's a frozen product, actually upon preparation, it's as fresh as any fish they're ever going to get.
Right.
And then the sustainability message around frozen at sea and being shipped frozen is something that puts a carbon footprint on our product unlike really any other protein out there.
You know, it kind of got stuck in that world because it's such a large production. The biomass is the biggest in the world, I think. It kind of got stuck in that area of fish and chips and McDonald's fish fillet. You know, so it never or surimi or things like that. People never really looked at it on its own as a great product, especially in fine dining restaurants. And so that's what we've been working on lately. Mr. Bob Dostel from Global Seas, what do you have to say about wild Alaskan pollock?
Well, the one thing I got to say is people come to Seattle here and they go down the fish market and they see wild, sustainable Alaskan fish. And the first thing they see is a very expensive fish from $20, $30, $40, $50 a pound. While Alaska pollock is on a lower scale rate of cost. And so people are going, wow, I can finally get a piece of fish out of Alaska that's sustainable, it's managed well, it tastes delicious for a reasonable price. Mm-hmm. And it's not deep fried. Mm-hmm. And that's been part of our problem all along here is because there's been so much of abundance of the fish. Last year, in particular in the Bering Sea, 3.3 billion pounds of fish was mm-hmm. caught mm-hmm. by harvesters out of Alaska.
That's sustainably caught.
Sustainably caught.
Yeah.
Then if you add in the Russian side of it, you double it. But in Alaska, we're MSC qualified, certified, and bringing the best fish that we can. So it's always been a large, vast amount of fish that we got to put in a market. So it's been more of a plug and play mm-hmm. for years and years and years. And as we've developed the fishery, now we need to be able to take this and elevate the value of the fish, mm-hmm. elevate it and bring it to the consumer and show the consumer what a great fish it is.
Yeah. Terry, you've used pollock before.
Yeah, many
times. Recently I've been using pollock noodles. What have you done with the pollock center of the plate with a nice fillet?
Well, you know, sadly enough, I'm not sadly, but this is the time of the year where I start thinking of pollock because pollock, mashed potato, and truffles, you put those three things together and I guarantee you, you're going to have a mouthful of deliciousness. It's going to be very, very nice.
You just take an inexpensive pollock and just made it with truffle.
Well, I was just trying to say it's a celebratory fish. I mean, just like anything else. You know, it's like it's much harder to get salmon fresh in December than it is to get pollock on the plate right away. So, you know, you can get all those fish available and a good seafood sauce, like a shrimp sauce, around your pollock with mashed potato and truffle. Mm-hmm. I tell you, nobody's going to say no to that. Mm-hmm. Granted, you don't have to go that high, but it's a very easy fish to put on the plate, and a little bit of drizzled olive oil, salt, pepper, put it in the oven. 5 minutes later, you got a piece of fish that's cooked perfectly normal and absolutely beautiful. So I don't know. I think it's an easy one to do. Good baked cod.
Yeah,
Pollack.
Last month, our industry held its first ever Waalaska Pollack annual meeting, and we talked a lot about the research. One of the things that we did is we launched a brand-new website. The website's all about helping consumers understand everything there is to know about our perfect protein, our Waalaska Pollack. We've put on that site some recipes that are associated with influencers like Antoni Porowski. We have a partnership with Martha Stewart. We have a partnership with, obviously, we have a partnership with Trident and the protein noodles. But putting recipes out there that are easy for consumers to prepare with products that are easy to find in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. You know, you must know Mark Snyder. He's an evangelical about pollock and all of its uses. Recently, out at the Admiral's House, Robert, that's where your offices are.
That's where our corporate office
is. Yeah,
exactly.
We did a tasting of all pollock in all sorts of ways and had guys like Shiro Toshiba out there tasting it, myself, Terry, all sorts of chefs from around town. There's a lot of excitement about pollock.
There's a lot of excitement about pollock. And the other excitement that's kind of happening here, it's directly related to Seattle. The Seattle fleet is based out of Seattle, goes up to Alaska, catches the fish, it rolls right back through Seattle here. And we're finally starting to get in some of the white tablecloth restaurants. Thank you very much, Mr. Douglas. Mm-hmm. It's great. We've got other people, Wild Ginger finally put it on, Ricky Oder, Leo Varchetta from Cinque Terre. So by having you guys showcase that fish, it actually is presenting the fish to the public, and people are really loving it. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's a pleasure for us because we are looking for other fish to fish or to actually cook and serve. Because besides salmon, cod, halibut, you know, we have a huge amount of fish in the Pacific Ocean. It's the biggest body of water. So, yes, bring more to the table, yes.
Well, we're going to bring more to the table sustainably.
Exactly.
Exactly. I made some wild pollock out of frozen fish, which all the pollock that I've ever had is done previously frozen.
Right.
But gnocchi. You ever make fish gnocchi? Or it's kind of like a fish sausage or fish dumpling without the casing.
So do you cut the fish in small pieces and mix it in your gnocchi at the last minute, or do you?
Yeah, I cut it in small pieces, and this probably isn't what the wild pollock producers want, but I love it because it adds protein, and so I do 50% pollock, 50% kind of a mashed potato or riced potato, you know what I mean by that?
Right.
Of course you do. And then I mix the two together and then simply poach them in a little bouillon. Made from the bones, and then serve it with a little custardy
that's
cream
really
sauce.
Cool.
Or that shrimp sauce that you talked about would be good with that.
Clever.
A little goat cheese in there, pollock, goat cheese, and potato. It makes a beautiful dumpling.
Yeah, it's kind of like when I was a kid, we used to have pollock as a layer of mashed potato, layer of pollock ground, layer of mashed potato, gratiné, and that was lunch. You'd have that for lunch.
When you were a kid?
Yeah.
You came home from lunch, your mom just kind of had that spread.
No, that was at school. That was at school cafeteria.
Oh,
it wasn't a cafeteria. It was a. You came in, you sit down, you had a three-course lunch, and that was cool.
Is that the school where you were an apprentice, or is that your
school? School, like when I was 7, 8, 9,
that
10.
That is ridiculous.
Why?
Well, in our school, ketchup was the vegetable.
Oh, yeah, no, we had a three-course lunch every day. That was actually, that's why we last longer.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
We can drink more and eat more for the rest of our life.
Yeah, no, we had fish and chips and ketchup. That was all we had. Maybe on a good day, we had tartar sauce.
Every Friday we had seafood. That was a rule at school.
All right, we're going to wrap this up. Any last words?
No, just keep eating more Waalaska pollock in more ways more often. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
All right, up next, it's time for questions from you, our trusted listeners, all about our cooking, and we're going to jump right into that on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Thank you.
It's the Seattle Kitchen Show, live from Pacific Marine Expo down here in SoTo. Are we actually in SoTo? We're kind of on SoTo.
I think it's like just before you get to SoTo.
We're actually on the site of the Old Kingdom.
Yeah, exactly.
Most people now know it as CenturyLink Field.
Yes,
but
exactly.
You know.
Well, I'm old, so deal with it. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And we're going to start down the list of questions that we got on our Facebook page from our listeners. And I think today, or this segment is when I'm going to start my surprise of the day, which is I got in a mistaken batch of my book called I Love Crab Cakes.
Ooh.
So for every listener that goes to our Facebook page and says something about I love crab cakes, I am going to have a book set aside at the Hot Stove Society. Unless you send me a check, I'm not mailing all these out. But
so you have to come to the Hot Stove Society.
Yeah, I'm
going to
limit it to 250 books.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
You can't all come at once.
Can't all come at once. But you can come down anytime, pick up your book. I'll have a special radio show version of our signature, so we'll know who's going to where. And so, yeah, I'm going to donate for anyone who goes onto our Facebook page and says, I want a copy of Tom's I Love Crab Cake books. It'll make a nice Christmas present. You can do all that you want with it, but you'll have to pick it up at the Hot Stove Society. So you got to come down starting December 2nd. It's my Thanksgiving present to all of our listeners who love crab cakes. So just go to hotstovesociety.com or seattlekitchen.com.
Actually, what you have to do is head over to Facebook. You should already have an account. And just search for Seattle Kitchen. And
if you don't, you can use Tina's account.
It's at Seattle Kitchen on Facebook, so yeah. Super easy to find us.
I love how you said you should already have an account, because my team won't let me have an account.
Well, everybody but Tom Douglas can have an account.
All right, let's get to our questions from our listeners. We're going to start with Cody Cochran. What's the best alternative for garlic in a recipe? I have a good sensitivity to garlic, and I haven't found a good substitute.
A substitute. Well,
I would start with ginger, personally.
Ginger is a great substitute. It's got a nice perkiness. It's not spicy, but it's got a bite.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like garlic does. You know, it picks you alive, and it stays with you for a couple of hours. You know, it's nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for digestion.
Right, and I think of garlic as being kind of that, an identifier ingredient. When you taste it, you know it.
Right.
And so, to me, other things like maybe the toasted or the browned shallots that's something that would really be... Well, she says garlic. She doesn't say onions.
No, that's true.
If it's not all onions,
it's good.
Yeah.
That's good, yeah.
So I would say shallots or ginger would be a place that I would start as
Absolutely.
A substitute for garlic. Okay. Tony Raymond asked us a question about social issues here in downtown Seattle and why we're such a crazy city. And I don't know what to say.
You're on our Facebook page, I
don't want to ignore it, but it's just not what we do on the show a whole ton. So, Tony, maybe come back to us with a cooking question, and we'd be happy to answer it. Terry Benson, what's your favorite cranberry sauce recipe? Fresh only, though.
Yes. So, sauteed some onions. I sliced some onions. I sauteed them, put all my cranberry in there, a dash of white wine, fresh thyme chopped, put that in there, and a little dash of just a tiny bit of chili, like cayenne pepper or chili pepper. Preferably, if you have a light smoked chili, that would be delicious. And then put that in there and cook it down slowly until all your cranberries are very tender. Finish with a dash of salt. And then here we go. You have a sauce, cranberry sauce on the side for your turkey.
Mm, lovely. Nathan Corley, if you go to our Facebook page, you also can have a crab cake book. Anyone that goes to our Facebook page, up to 250 people can get a crab cake book. What is your favorite dim sum spot in Seattle? So there's several to me. Here's the thing about Seattle dim sum, in my opinion. I go to whoever's got room. Because they all are essentially the same.
And I didn't know anything about dim sum until I came to Seattle. And you introduced me to a very important point about dim sum. Go at 10:55 a.m. when they open at 11. Everything you'll have will be running around fresh out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
And it will be delicious.
I think of dim sum a little bit like Dick's Burgers. If you go to a Dick's Burger and there's no line, just keep on driving. Because the burgers have been sitting for a bit, and they get a little soggy. I go to Dick's Burgers when there's a big line, and you know that boom, 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 they're coming off the griddle, and they're crispy, and everything's hot and great. I'm not trashing Dick's Burgers at all. I love them. But I'm just saying that's when I like to go.
Yep.
Dim sum's very much the same thing. Go to a restaurant that's got a full house so that the product is coming out of the kitchen consistently, and it's not running around in an empty dining room getting cold on the cart. But going back to my first thing was... Essentially, the dim sum restaurants in Seattle are very similar. They have similar menus, similar preparations. You might find some little differences in the humbao, the baked humbao with the barbecue pork center, or you might find the normai gai, which is the glutinous rice with the lap chong sausage in the center of it. You might find them in large packages or small packages. They're wrapped in lotus leaves and really fragrant. You might find a difference in the lobako, which is the kind of the turnip cake with the
I know it's one of your favorites.
Rice flour, glutinous rice flour as the binder. They might be hot. They might be brown more than some others. But typically, the menu's similar. They're very similar in quality, whether it's Jay Garden, House of Hong, Harbor Village, you name it. All of those places are very similar.
So. House of Hong is poking.
Okay. Patty Bornheimer, she wants to know, salted or unsalted butter for the holiday baking? You, too, win a Tom Douglas I Love Crab Cake book by going to our Facebook page and posting this question.
I would go unsalted because you can always add salt. And especially in pastries, if your pastry requires a little salt, you know, you brush a little egg wash on top of your pie, you finish with a little sea salt, and you put it in the oven for about 1 minute. The whole thing cooks and stay there. That's one thing if you're doing like a chicken pot pie or something like this. That can be very helpful. Mm-hmm. But in general, no salt in my dough. It does not work. As in, we can always add it, but I don't like to have it at the beginning.
Okay, Lori Dragseth says she recently saw Chef Sean Brock, who's very well known in the South, both in Nashville and in Charlotte, I believe, about his new cookbook and heritage seed preservation efforts. What are your thoughts on heritage seeds, and is anyone locally doing the same? And I picked this question because, of course, Jackie, my wife out at Prosser Farm, is working with Row 7 Seeds and the University of Oregon, or Oregon State, one of those two, working on heritage seeds and seed trials and over at Prosser Farm, and is loving every minute of it. She has found her passion for developing better produce, but organically and with a system with the importance of not on being looks, but on flavor and production. So,
and it is there's a whole world of seeds out there. That's a very important. Once you start getting into it, it's pretty intense. There's a huge amount of, it's a big population of people just caring about seed that are on the planet, and the heirloom seed especially. So
I agree. All right, coming up, it's the ins and outs of cooking on board a fishing vessel. I've always wanted to do that and never had the chance.
I just care. I mean, those waves are big.
I know, exactly. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Pacific Marine Expo 2019 down here at CenturyLink Event Center. Chef, we're having a good old time here.
I'm glad it's low tide. That's all I can say. We can actually admire all these boats and everything. It's nice.
It's nice. And one of the things that I've always thought about doing, being from the Pacific Northwest now for the last 40-plus years, I always wondered what it would be like to go up as one of the cooks on these big trawlers or one of the fishing boats.
Have you ever cooked on the boat?
Never cooked. Well, as a guest chef on like one of the ships, the big.
Yeah.
But never on something going up and down on 40-foot waves. And on a little touring boat around Lake Union or something like that, I've been cooked on. But
I guess we have an expert. We can ask him.
Yeah, Dan Ewert is here. He's the cook on the FV Siberian Sea. And he's a Washington resident who's been cooking on board commercial fishing vessels for over 20 years in Alaska. He has experience on crab boats, freezer longline vessels. He has cooked on 5 different vessels in the Freezer Longline Coalition and currently serves as the main cook on board, like I said, the FV Siberian Sea. Dan also studied culinary arts at Puget Sound Community College. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Great, thanks. Thanks for having
me. Welcome to the show. Tell us what it's like. I think there's a lot of people that wonder how, you know, they watch The Deadliest Catch or something crazy like that, and they wonder how the heck you do your job. How does the hot coffee not just fall all over you?
The stock, the soup.
Lots of duct tape and rope. And,
really? Just like going to the moon?
Yeah. Sometimes.
Give us an idea of what it's like and what do you do? What's your day look like on one of these big fishing boats?
Well, we cook 3 meals a day, so I have to have a meal prepared every 8 hours. Mm-hmm. And so pretty much my schedule is work 4 hours, I'm off for 4 hours. I work for 4 hours, I'm off for 4 hours. And that never stops till I'm done. And but you know the seas get really rough, and so the challenge there is the keeping the things from falling all over the place and rolling off the tables, and so you got lots of oven mitts and pads that you can set your pots and pans on when you're taking them off the heat, and so they don't slide around, and then you come up with ideas just to make things not slosh inside the oven, you know. So I'll cover it with foil and then cut a box out of the middle, you know, so, and then put it in the oven, and then put another hotel pan just beside it, so it doesn't slide around inside the pan.
Yeah, I always think about that when on the buffet table, but I wasn't even thinking about actually inside the oven. Interesting.
Yeah.
Now your provisions, you don't get to go shopping every day.
No. Nope.
So you have to provision and plan your menu in advance and provision your boat. Is that a big deal?
Yeah. You want to make sure you have everything you need.
Mm-hmm. For how long?
Yeah, you can't run to the store.
At least 30 days.
30 days.
For 30 days, yeah.
And describe a little bit the quarters. What does it look like, a kitchen on a fishing vessel? What does that, I mean, how big is it, first of all?
In our galley, we got a three-compartment for the hotline, compartments. And I got a full-size flat grill and a double fryer and a convection oven with three racks. And then I have two burners for cooking.
And how many people do you feed every day?
21.
Wow. 21, three times a day.
That's 60 meals.
Yeah.
70 meals by the time you're done, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. I don't imagine they all eat at the same time. You have to keep that buffet out for 4 hours?
Exactly. Yeah. They eat in shifts, so I'll prepare the meal, and then that shift is woke up, and then they come down and eat, and then they go out and get ready, and then the next group comes in, and they eat. And then they go back out, and then the next group comes in, they eat, and then they get to go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get to clean up and go to bed as well.
And, of course, the main question is, you're fishing millions of pounds of pollack or cod or whatever fish. Are you actually allowed to take those fish and cook them?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Cod. Mostly cod. And
so is that the other way around? They eat cod every meal?
Well, if the captain could have it, it would be every meal. But the guys, you know, they want different things. So I cook cod at least about three times a week.
Right.
You know, and do fish. They love fish and chips. Do homemade fish and chips with cod.
Now, you're out for 30 days. You're cooking three meals a day. You're only getting 4 hours of sleep in between, maybe. And somebody gives you guff about what you made. It's like, say, yo, Dan, what about this cod tonight? It's just not up to snuff. Do you just throw them off the side of the boat? Or do you just not feed them for 2 days and then they learn their lesson? Then what do you do when somebody gives you a hard time?
That sounds like
you control it, right?
I could too, but I've never had really a complaint. The guys are really great up there, so, you know, I've been
They're probably
for
very
that.
Thankful to get a hot meal being on the freezing cold day of the ocean. So.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes some of the cooks aren't as experienced. So, you know, when they get one that's well experienced, they really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and a lot of my favorite foods to cook are the cooks that they get excited about, that they really like, you know.
What's your favorite cod recipe, as long as we're here at the Fisherman's Expo?
Oh, I like doing the fish tacos. Mm-hmm. At the Unicy in Dutch Harbor, they have a fish tacos there. And, because usually I just tell the guys, hey, you know, let me know, you know, what you'd like. You know, tell me about something that you've eaten at home that I can make, you know, you can figure it out. So I had the fish tacos at the Unicy, and they were really good. And so I kind of developed my own recipe from their recipe.
Do you also make your own recipe before you leave and then put them on the boat frozen, or like soups or stocks or anything like that?
No.
You do everything on the boat?
Yeah, I don't have quite, you know, enough storage for stuff like that. But so everything's fresh. So like when I thaw things out just before the meal. Mm-hmm. I don't let things sit in the fridges.
So isn't it interesting to think that here you're watching these guys go up 30, 40-foot waves, and they're just bouncing around, and they're 30 days out, and really underwater in the galley, they're just eating fish tacos, just having a good old time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fresh margaritas, fish tacos.
Happy fishermen.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. Who knew? All right, thank you so much, Dan. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Dan Lewis, he's the chef for the Siberian Sea Vessel. Up next, we're going to go back to our series on the joy of cooking, the new cookbook out for the holiday season. We loved it on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. All right, welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. My good friend Terry took a breather while I have had a week of inspiration from the new Joy of Cooking book. Megan Scott and John Becker are back with us. Last week we talked about the history of the new Joy of Cooking. Now we're going to get into some of the nuts and bolts. And I did. We're going to break this into segments, as I told you last week, and use these all throughout the Christmas season because cookbook shopping, the number one time of year for cookbook shopping, is this very season. So, I don't know if you guys know this or not, but I host a cookbook social every year at the Palace Ballroom, and where we have chefs, mostly regional chefs, come in with their new book and make a little taste for everyone to have. And it was super fun. It's our 15th year of the cookbook social. Okay, Megan Scott, John Becker, last week we talked about the history. This week I want to talk about the new recipes. You told me off the air that there's some 600 new recipes in this book. And, you know, as I asked you before, I feel very old because I knew several of the contributors to the last rewrite of The Joy of Cooking, which makes me really old. So
yeah, I was graduating high school when it was published.
So. Oh, that hurts. Don't you feel a certain responsibility in messing around with what many consider the classic tome of cooking of all time?
It's a weighty responsibility, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think we definitely took it very seriously after, you know, I mean, we tested 1,500 recipes before we even started on the revision. And during that time, we were also dealing with, Joy's email, you know, social media, and we definitely got to know some of our readers, like, very well, and they would share some really personal stories with us, and we definitely felt beholden to them, as well as, you know, the family. Yeah,
every day it was kind of like, okay, we can't mess up today. Just don't mess up today.
I'm sure it must be interesting to deal with Irma Rombauer and her version of things, which, is there anything left from her, or has it been rewritten about five times?
This is the ninth revision. Okay. So actually, since the 1931 edition, I think that we, in one form or another, it's like about 150, maybe 200 recipes that have been in the book from that first edition that she self-published in 1931. Okay.
Yeah. So what did you find new? What is happening now that wasn't happening 25 years ago? Because that's kind of what the whole idea is when you update it.
Right. It's kind of remarkable how many things have changed. I think one of the biggest changes we were trying to account for is just the incredible availability of so many different types of ingredients now that you could not even find even 10 years ago. Now you can find things like gochujang in your average supermarket, which is kind of remarkable.
And it's way hotter than you think.
Yeah.
Some varieties are much harder than others,
yeah,
I found out.
You have to try them to see if they're hot. But so we wanted to kind of speak to that. And so a lot of the new recipes we added are, we added a bunch of international recipes, kimchi jjigae, like a Guyanese pepper pot, which is an amazing stew that has an ingredient called cassareep in it, which is like a cassava molasses that is incredibly delicious.
And then also, you know, expanding on the repertoire of, Thai dishes that we have. So instead of just offering like a pad Thai recipe and, things of that nature, we now have a khao soi, which is great this time of year, actually. It's one of my favorite cold weather dishes.
What do you make? How do you make that?
Oh, it's a braised bone-in chicken curry. It's got kind of it's not quite as heavy on the coconut milk as a lot of some of the curries that we're used to, but it's also not like a quote-unquote jungle curry that's just broth. So, you know, it's kind of a in-between broth. It has, you know, some influence from kind of a Chinese influence because it's a northern Thai dish, but it also has a turmeric in it and, of course, egg noodles. And then it's topped with a fried egg noodle topping. So you get, it's like noodles, egg noodles two ways. It's delicious.
I love that.
And we were also kind of expanding on a lot of American classics that were not covered in previous editions. So things like Chicago-style deep dish pizza, strawberry sonker, which is like a regional North Carolina dessert. It's kind of like a cobbler. Appalachian apple stack cake.
Gooey butter cake with St. Louis specialty, which, you know, we were really scratching our heads on that one because obviously Irma's from St. Louis, and it's like, I guess maybe she just had it and didn't like it, but it's absolutely delicious.
Uh-huh. So it never made the book in from her version, huh? The same?
No.
Huh, interesting. The, such a celebration of local cuisine over the last 50 years compared to, what do I know about 50 years before that? I'm a youngster, but But it's interesting to go back and celebrate those dishes. When you talk about all these other things like the Thai food and stuff, it really wasn't 20 years you couldn't even go that you couldn't get those ingredients.
Right, or you would have to go to a specialty store or, find some other source for them. But now they're so ubiquitous, and I think people's palates have also changed over the past 25 years. I think people are just a lot more open-minded when it comes to the foods that they're eating.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that, like, for instance, in the last edition, I think we covered maybe a dozen varieties of dried chilies, and now we try to address, like, what I think over 3 dozen. So that, and like, you know, even just the kinds of mushrooms you can find nowadays, you know, the quote unquote wild mushrooms. I mean, it's just I think we had like maybe 8 mushrooms that we talked about in the last edition, and now it's more like, you know, two dozen.
Amazing. I'm talking with Megan Scott and John Becker. They're the updaters of the new Joy of Cooking, a top 10 list of many lists that I've looked at for this holiday season. Any favorite recipes out of the book? We're talking recipes right now, especially the new ones, but of the new recipes, we're going to get into beginner cooking. Mm-hmm. The following week, we're going to get into baking out of this new book, but let's just talk about the new recipes in there and any ones that are your favorites.
It is a tough question because, you know, out of 600 new ones, it's like, I love them all. They're all my children. But the olive oil cake is fantastic. It has orange juice and zest and cornmeal. So it's just like this really rich, flavorful cake that's made with olive oil instead of butter. And I love to serve that with whipped creme fraiche and whatever fruits in season, whether it's like citrus segments or roasted pears or fresh strawberries. So I make that one all year long. I mentioned earlier the Guianese pepper pot. That's become one of our favorite dishes to make in the winter. It's just extremely satisfying.
I also developed a Calabrian style chili, you know, preserved under oil.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud of that recipe.
Yeah, those are fantastic.
So you like to make those, and you give them away for Christmas or something cool?
Yeah,
like that?
Not for Christmas, unfortunately. I should save
them.
We're
kind of selfish with them.
Oh, okay.
They just don't last until Christmas, unfortunately. But I do give them away when I can.
Give me a 1-minute version of that Viennese or Vietnamese dish that you talked about.
Which one?
The one you just mentioned.
Oh, the Guianese pepper pot.
Yeah, so it's a braised dish that you can use lamb, goat, or beef. We usually use beef. It's great with lamb. But it's basically stewed with cassareep, a cassava molasses that has spices and different seasonings in it. The dish also has some whole spices that you include. So it almost has like a gingerbread quality, but it's really savory
it's got
and rich.
Cinnamon, cloves, allspice, orange zest. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It almost sounds like a jerk combination, like a Jamaican jerk combination.
It's a little bit.
It's pretty similar.
Yeah.
Definitely, like, I think it's traditionally served on Christmas Day, and, you know, kind of that has a nice broth that you sop up with white bread. It's delicious.
White bread, not white rice. That's interesting, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. All right, cool. Next week, we're going to talk about beginner recipes for beginner cooks in the new Joy of Cooking update. Our guests have been Megan Scott and John Becker. And we are going to savor this book all through the holiday season here on the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're back in the Seattle Kitchen. It's time for a little fish talk, which we've been doing all day long here from the Pacific Marine Expo. Happened to be here for, I believe, our 5th year in a row. Chef Terry.
Yes, sir.
We've got a nice little block of time here to kind of tackle one of my favorite fish from the waters here of not only the Sound and all across our area, but also all the way up into Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
The unbelievable black cod.
And
sometimes
I think,
called sable fish.
Yeah, and I think it's caught on to a lot of other chefs.
Caught on to?
No pun intended, but I think more people have their line in the water.
Mm-hmm.
I think that more and more chefs are really catching on to how great of a piece of meat that is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, black cod is, to those of you listening out there who have never had a black cod, I would describe it as one of the most unctuous piece of fish you can possibly eat. It is a little bit slightly oily.
Slightly?
Huge. Well, it's not like a sardine or a mackerel.
It's oily enough that you can't really overcook it.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's where I was going with that.
Yeah.
So the point is that you can cook a piece of cod too much. It's very forgiving, and it's a beautiful piece of fish. And it can go well fried, sauteed, baked in the oven, steamed. I mean, it does well in so many different situations of cooking.
I agree it does well in many, but I think it does best in some.
Correct.
To me, it's not best deep fried at all.
No.
Like fish and chips kind of fried. It's too rich for that. But steaming, love it. It's
and baked.
Beautifully steamed, baked.
It does well baked. I mean, I've done many times taking the cod and putting something right on top, either a mixture of olives or whatever I was doing, and put that in the oven and just let it cook and come out 10 minutes later, and you get this marvelous piece of fish that's like flaky, because cod does flake out, and it's a beautiful piece of fish.
And let's stay on the black cod, because you keep saying cod, but that's very different, right?
Correct. Black
you're getting
cod.
True cod, link
cod. We're talking
cod.
Black cod.
Black cod is what we're talking about for this whole segment, so let's stay
but
on that.
But you introduced me to a very Asian style of black cod than you did at Cafe Sport when I first came to Seattle, and you became very famous for it. And I was totally blown away, because I was like, oh my God, this is kind of like the sweet and delicious fish you've never had before.
Well, here's the thing about that, and I'm not sure if you want to call it cultural appropriation, which is a hot term these days, but you know, that cod, when I was, I want to say 19 or 20 years old, I had a birthday dinner at the Mikado restaurant in downtown Seattle, 5th and Jackson. I believe it's called the Red Lantern now, but it was called the Mikado, and Hite was the chef there, and one of the 20 courses that I had for dinner was the miso, or what we call a kasuzuke black cod, and that is the, they take the sediment from sake brewing tanks, and that's the lees, right, of the sake brewing tanks, and then they add miso, brown sugar, things like that to it, and I prefer the sediment. You can buy it two ways. You can buy it kind of strained out, or you can buy it, which is kind of whitish, or the golden orange unstrained katsu paste, and that's what I like. It's got fermentation going on. You mix in the miso, maybe a little mirin, which is sweetened sake, some miso paste, and the sugar, and you've got this incredible
glaze.
Marinade, right? And so what Harry Yoshimura at Mutual Fish told me, and he keeps it in his case, if you ever want this, you don't have to make it. The recipe is in my book, but you don't have to make it. If you ever want, just go down to Mutual Fish on Rainier Avenue, and in the case, you'll see this kind of pasty-looking black cod.
Right.
And there's a couple of tricks to it. One is you freeze the black cod first, just as a fresh fish, right? So that when you slack it out, it loses some of its water content. And now you've got a fish that is really oily because the water's gone.
And very open to receive anything.
Yeah. So now you've got this. Now you have the katsu marinade. Then you put it on. Skin on. You leave the skin on.
Right.
And he leaves the bone in, actually. I have to trim the bone out when I buy it. But it's just the most delicious thing. The other trick that he taught me was that you don't buy black cod in the 1 to 2 pound category. Ever, he says, because at 3 pounds they start to put on that fat content of their
that's
of their
when they get delicious
starts to change, right? And so you're the 1 pound,
just like me. I was much better today with a round of fat than I was when I was 25 years old with no fat on,
right? But the 1 to 2 pounders, they haven't had that transition yet, and it's very much like cooking ling cod or true cod.
It's
just much leaner.
Yeah.
But once they start to hit that 3 to 5 pound range, I never buy a black cod that's less than 3 pounds. They become a different fish and have a different fat content. And I got to say, that particular dish, the miso black cod, is what you see it oftentimes in restaurants around the world, or the kasuzuke black cod is what we call it. Same dish.
Right, katsu cod,
that is unbelievable.
It is absolutely. If you've never had katsu cod, you owe it to yourself to try the dish, because it is absolutely delicious way to eat fish. And you'll never think of fish when you're eating it either. It
I know, doesn't, it's just different.
It does not remind me of fish. When I eat katsu cod, it does not remind me of fish. It reminds me of something much different. And so let's go through the cooking method. So you've got the cod marinating.
Yeah, super simple, right? A saute pan, a little bit of oil, and then you're going to, if you want to pan fry it, you're going to just pan fry one side till it's golden brown. And there's sugar in the marinade, so it caramelizes quickly.
Right.
And then just flip it and pop it in the oven and finish it, or low and slow on top of the stove. And like I said earlier, you cannot I mean, you can overcook it. Yes,
right.
You can. But it's hard to overcook because it just gets, the fat is just there, right? And when you're overcooking it, you're taking the water out and intensifying the fat. So it's like eating foie gras or something of that nature,
right?
Just super fatty and delicious and such a
lovely
thing.
My favorite garnish of this is pickled ginger and seaweed salad, you know, like they sell, talking about Mutual Fish.
That was the original version of Cafe Sport.
Yeah, it's so delicious. And because those three ingredients together are so much umami, then it's amazing.
When I talk about cultural preparation earlier, it is the fact that when I had this at this classic, I mean, this is a 1,000-year-old recipe. This is nothing new.
Right, right.
But when I had it at this in this classic kind of multi-course Japanese dinner, I kind of picked it out as my favorite dish of the night, and I put it on my menu and got it from Mutual Fish. But honestly, I think I was the first Caucasian to kind of offer that taste to a more generally white, non-Asian audience.
Right.
And in the beginning, I had to throw it away when it went bad because it just didn't sell. People didn't understand it. But once they started to try it, people started coming back for it. And that's where I say it's cultural appropriation because it is a classic Japanese, old-time Japanese dish. You'll see it on Morimoto's menus.
Right.
You'll see it on Nobu's menus, you know, very famous Japanese chefs.
Right.
I'm sure Shiro Kashiba down at Kashiba's serves it. Yeah. So I just took it because I loved it, you know, as I do with all my cooking. I'll take inspiration from anywhere, and whether it's a dumpling from Szechuan noodle bowl that I want to recreate, or whether it's the Okinawa pancake that I want to recreate, or the miso cod. I don't care what it is. It could even be, doesn't even have to be Asian or Mexican. It could just be a Southern charm that I found when I was visiting Atlanta or something. I always...
And something you do well is mix the two together, as in you're not just sticking to making it just pure Asian, or you're actually mixing it.
I try to keep I honestly do try to keep a dish in one area. I will often put a Japanese dish on a menu with an Italian dish or something like that.
But
I try not to mix the two.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's fantastic. I mean, Kasukod, you're still serving it?
I don't have it on the menu right now because it became so popular, it became a bit ubiquitous.
Yeah.
What I do now with black cod, which I really like this, matter of fact, I'm doing it at the hot stove in a couple of weeks, is I'll take parchment paper. This is a French technique, right? I'll take parchment paper and papillote. I'll put my black cod in there, and then I like to do a little kind of anise or some sort of flavor with it. So I'll take a little...
Southern Mediterranean.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. I make a little egg omelet or a little egg, a whisk egg, really fluffy.
Right.
And I put maybe some slivers of celery and some anise seeds and the egg and maybe a little touch of ouzo in the papillote. And then I wrap it all up with a big slab of butter and I bake that. And it steams kind of in a licorice.
I'm stealing this.
In a licorice bath. But the egg solidifies when it bakes, right?
Sure.
And it's it kind of holds those ingredients. It holds those ingredients on top of the cod rather than everything kind of going down to the bottom.
Right.
And I just think it's a beautiful fragrance. When you cut open the papillote at the table and it releases the steam from the casing, oh, it's just such a beautiful fragrance. And I did that dish many, many years ago, and I pull it out every once in a while to put it back on a menu here or there. But I think it's a lovely way. Steaming cod, black cod, is an awesome way to cook it.
That's right. Ooh, so delicious.
So delicious. Okay, it might be time, could be time, it is time for our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
Mm.
And I'm just going to reiterate one more time. I'm having a big Thanks for Thanksgiving giveaway this weekend. If you go to our Facebook page, you can get a free I Love Crab Cakes cookbook, up to 250 people.
What do you have to do?
You have to go to our page and say, I want the book. So that way I know you were listening. But also, there was a mix-up in ordering, and I got all these books, and I don't need all those books, right? So I have extras. So I'm going to give them away as a Thanksgiving holiday present. You can do whatever you want with them, but you have to pick them up at the Hot Stove Society in downtown Seattle if you actually want them. So if you live downtown, or if you work downtown, or if you know somebody downtown that could drop on by and bring it to you, that would be fine. I love crab cakes. Up next, Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia. It's going to be fun. Who's going to win? That's always the big question on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. We are back. It's our last segment here from Pacific Marine Expo here down at the CenturyLink Events Center. We've been happy to be the guest of National Fisherman Magazine here and the whole show. It's really exciting to see all the different parts of fishing boats kind of splayed out all over the place. It's fun to kind of go over there, go over there, go over there, get all the parts, and then build a boat.
That would be fun for some.
Yeah.
I would rather just step right on one already made.
Exactly. So it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Tina from Large Media, our producer, LARJ Media, is going to administer our quiz. And you said you're going to give us extra questions today.
I am going to have to give you some extra questions today, chefs, because you're just playing with the two of you. Usually we have three people. We rope somebody else in to play against you. Mm-hmm. Now it's head-to-head.
All
right. Tom and Terry.
How do you feel, Tom?
I feel strong.
You're both looking good. You're looking good today.
I had breakfast this morning, a spinach and feta cheese omelet. So
it's like
what
Popeye.
I had was a strong banana.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. That was going to be tough. All right, you guys. Here's what we're going to do. I'll give each of you seven questions. Whoever gets the most correct is obviously the winner. And whoever is not the winner today is going to give something away, something precious that you own or love. And what's really fun about our experience here at the Pacific Marine Expo is that we've come now 4 or 5 years in a row, and we've gotten to know some people. We have some regulars. So our dear friend Shannon is here with her husband and her darling daughter. We met them before the darling daughter even existed and just before the two of them got married. So it's really fun to see the two of you here today with us. And we'd love to play our trivia question, our game for you today so that we can give you a prize.
Oh, nice.
So it'll be super fun. All right, Chef Thierry, you lose today, what will you give to our friends?
Have you guys been to Luke?
Yes.
Have you guys been to Lule?
Luke and Lule's?
No.
Sounds like they have not
all
been
right.
to
Lule. So we'll get you brunch for all three of you at Lule if I lose today.
What do you mean if, Chef?
Well, I'm just saying, there was always that chance that I might not lose. But there's always that chance I will lose.
All right, Chef Tom Douglas, what will you give to Shannon and her family?
Well, as long as we're doing brunch, let's do brunch at the Carlisle Room, right across the street from the Paramount Theater. A brunch for three. What was the value of your brunch?
Priceless.
Oh, it's priceless.
Yeah.
I'm not falling for that one.
Mine has a $100 cap on it, then.
So if Thierry loses, you guys get to stay there all day.
Yeah, you can
hear that?
You can stay there all day.
Endless mimosas.
Just hang out.
Bottomless.
And you guys, you know what I did for you? I did a special fish-themed quiz today.
Oh, nice.
To, stay in the theme. Who would like to go first?
I'll start. Go ahead.
All right, Chef Thierry, true or false, the trigger fish can swim backwards?
True.
That's correct. I think you get that one.
All right. If you can trigger, you can do anything.
Chef, your next question. Why can't goldfish close their eyes?
I don't know.
You have some options. Would you like me to give them to you?
Yes, please.
Because they move too quickly, because their eyes are just too big, or is it because they don't have eyelids?
I'm going to go with no eyelids.
Correct. Good job.
It's the only one that makes sense.
All right. Good job. 2 for 2. Question number 3 for you. Fish that seem tough when you bite into them after you've cooked them are what?
Overcooked.
Yep. Wow. Tom, are you nervous over there?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah? All right.
He wasn't a minute ago. Now he's starting to.
A perfect score so far. Question number 4. What should you do if you see fugu on the menu? F-U-G-U. Fugu.
You want to hope the chef knows what the hell he's doing, otherwise you're dead.
That's exactly right. Wow. I thought I was so clever when I wrote this one. No?
You are clever. I just happen to know the answer.
All right, Chef. Question number 5 for you. Approximately how many species of fish are there worldwide? 9,000, 27,000, 56,000, or 72,000 species of fish?
I'm going to go with 56 because it seems to be reasonable.
The answer is 27.
Ah, twice as many.
I mean,
twice as less. Okay.
Give or take.
Yeah, obviously, they all taste like fish.
First of all, I would like to know who the heck went in the water and counted all those fish.
All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4.
4 out of 5.
4 correct, 1 incorrect. Question number 6 for you, true or false. More than 90% of all fish caught are caught in the northern hemisphere. Is that true or false?
That's got to be false.
It's actually true.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the people in the south don't have any seafood?
I know.
90%?
90% caught
in
the northern hemisphere.
Wow, these are interesting numbers.
All right, question. Your last question. This is number 7. You have four correct, two incorrect. Mm-hmm. Dolphin fish, which isn't actually from dolphins, is another name for what?
You know it, Chef.
I know, but I'm trying to understand the question. Dolphin fish?
What's dolphin fish, Chef? What's dolphin fish?
What's another name for dolphin fish?
You know what's this. Another name?
Your son's married to one.
Yes, of course.
Tom, stop giving him hints. You're playing against him.
Oh, that's right.
Hawaiian?
I thought I was his friend.
Hawaiian?
No, but in Hawaii, you got
it. Oh, my gosh. I'm not giving you this one.
No, it's tuna?
Mahi-mahi.
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 Oh, what are you doing?
Four correct, three incorrect.
Wasn't your son's wife's name Mahi?
No.
Oh.
She's from Maui.
Oh, Maui.
That's close enough.
Oh, here we go. You guys sound like click and clack right now.
That's close enough, though. Maui, Mahi. You know, I should have get that one. Say the island twice. Okay. Maui, Maui?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to just move on from the Maui.
My turn.
Chef, four is the number to beat for you.
That should be easy.
Question number one, where is the world's largest supply of caviar? You have some options. You want them?
Yes.
The Caspian Sea, mm-hmm. the Mediterranean Sea, the Caribbean Sea, or the Gulf of Mexico?
You just made the last one up, I think. I'll say the Caspian Sea.
You forget
Sea.
Lake Washington.
Caspian Sea is correct, and you're also correct. I did make the last one up.
That was pretty obvious.
All right, Chef, question number two. When breaking off the tail of a lobster, a person may encounter a reddish-orange squishy substance where the tail meets the torso of the lobster. What is that?
That's the coral of the lobster.
It is.
Yeah.
And also the unfertilized eggs. That's exactly what that is. Wow. All right, question number three. This seafood, which definitely isn't a tuna, lives on the ocean floor. It can be served raw, cooked in a dish, or dried for later usage. It also has a use in traditional Chinese medicine. Which marine animal am I talking about right now? Octopus, sea cucumber, seaweed, or starfish?
Sea cucumber.
Yep. You have three correct. You need this one to tie with Chef Rotaro. What's the difference between crawfish and crayfish?
Personally, I don't think anything.
It's actually right. You had some options, but they're so dumb, I'm not going to give them to you. You already got it. Okay, it is now tied, you two.
Mm.
Question number five, Chef, you'll need this one right to beat Chef Rotaro. Lumi Lumi is a salmon dish in Hawaii. It gets its name from a Hawaiian word meaning what? You have some options.
Maui Maui.
I'll take some options.
Lomi Lomi, L-O-M-I, L-O-M-I. Season, grill, massage, or pound?
Season,
dun, dun, dun.
Grill, massage, or pound. So it's not grilled, typically, not the lomi lomi I've had.
Yep.
All right.
So season as in autumn or summer?
I'm
or
not going to help you.
Season as in salt and pepper.
I'm not going to help you.
I'm going to go with, season doesn't make sense, so I'll say it is season. Okay, season.
Nope.
Oh, struck by a traitor.
It's massage.
Massage.
Massage. All right, you guys. You are still tied up.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
I'm not watching him anymore. Block him from my view.
All right. Question number, what is he? Four correct,
six.
One incorrect. Six.
Five.
True or false, a clownfish will change its sex in its lifetime?
Sure, why not? Wouldn't we all if we could?
You are correct. And that makes you the winner.
Yay!
Yay.
All right. Looks like our friends are heading over to Lule for a delicious
Yes, you
brunch.
Are.
All right. Lule. If you want to be part of the show, you can join us, the community, on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. The show is produced by our friends at Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. And our sound engineer today is...
Me.
I don't know. He's from
it's
National
pretty
Fisherman.
Much me.
Yeah. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to HotStoveSociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. It comes with breakfast and hot coffee. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to Seattle Kitchen on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.